Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Tracy Weber.
And I'm Charlie Ornstein.
And we're here with Ken Benzinger, an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed News. Together with his colleagues Jessica Garrison and Jeremy Singer-Vine, Ken worked on a series of articles last year on major abuses in America's guest worker system. The stories recently won an Ellie Award for Public Interest Journalism, a top award from the American Society of Magazine Editors.
The visa program which they looked at was intended to bring foreign workers to the U.S. to take jobs that U.S. citizens wouldn't. But along the way, employers have taken advantage of it, mistreating foreign workers and cheating American workers out of jobs. The reporters also profiled a man who built an empire connecting American employers with foreign workers and lobbying for the visa program's expansion. Today, some have likened the program to a form of slavery. We're happy to reunite with Ken, who we work with at the LA Times. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you.
So tell us how you came upon this story.
Much credit to my colleague Jessica Garrison, who was looking into something about forestry, and a source passed her info about a recently filed criminal indictment against foremen of a work crew in forestry in the mountains of Northern California that alleged that these Mexican workers in the middle of the forest had been held at gunpoint by their employer, forced to live in tents and drink dirty river water and spoiled food. And it was just a very shocking set of allegations. And she said, is this a story in and of itself? And we took a look at it and read the legal papers together and noticed that the workers were all in this guest worker program that we'd never heard of before, called the H-2 guest worker program. And Jessica and I talked about it and whether that there was enough material for a standalone story. And Jessica and I came to the conclusion that maybe we should learn more about the H-2 guest worker program. And that's really where it started. It was one of those things where, as has happened to me a few times in my career, where I've come across something I'd never heard of, and it set off like the proverbial light bulb over my head and made me want to learn more.
When you read the stories, you're shocked that this is all going on in the United States. We always hear about these guest worker program abuses in other countries, but I was shocked. And in your opening scene of the first day, you talk about a situation out in Louisiana where two women are asked out on a date by two men, and then they pick them up, and the person who is running the place where they're working chases after them. How did you come across that case, and can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Mm-hmm. There had been a civil suit filed in that case. That was settled, and there wasn't too much material there, but it was one we'd found relatively early and had sort of set aside as a case of, you know, of interest. It was full of all kinds of crazy stuff about that employer and those poor women. One of the tiny things buried in it mentioned this anecdote that you're talking about, Tracy. So when we revisited it later on, sort of looking for a way to get into the story that would really bring in sharp focus kind of how horrible it would be to be one of these workers, we remembered that and decided to see what we could find out about that anecdote. And little bits and pieces through the court record and particularly through some attorneys in the case and then through public records we got from local law enforcement, we were able to piece together this night. And then kind of the reporting coup that was amazing was using Facebook to track down the guys that took these women out on dates and interviewing them about the experience was amazing. And they once we got them on the phone, they didn't want to get off and they wanted to talk about it. And they were outraged and really upset about it. And they were just total kind of hilarious gentlemen about it. So we were able from a lot of areas to put that together. And then I think late in the game, we got a hold of some depositions of some of the cops that had been involved or and witnessed it. There was the local town police in this little town called Mamou, Louisiana, was known as the Cajun Prairie. And the Cajun Prairie is the flatlands north of the bayou in Louisiana, and it's rice paddy country and it's crawfish country.
And those women were brought in to work in that industry?
That's right. They were brought in by a company called LT West, which is run by a pair of brothers, Troy and Craig West. And they do rice part of the year and they do crawfish another part of the year. And one of the delightful things I learned reporting the story is that those two products are actually complementary. They use the rice paddies after they harvest the rice to grow crawfish in them. So the same ponds grow crawfish, and then their waste and stuff actually fertilizes the ground below that they can grow the rice out of. So it might change your thought about eating a plate of Uncle Ben's, but they bring in these women, mostly women from Mexico, to peel the crawfish. So that was what they were doing.
So let's take a step back. Explain a little bit about the abuses in the system and how workers are mistreated.
So just to give you a sense of what the system is, it's called the H-2 guest workers system, or H-2 visa, and there's two branches to it. There's the H-2A, which is for agricultural jobs. There's the H-2B, which is for non-agricultural jobs. There's another program we didn't write about, which some of your listeners might have heard of, called the H-1B. This is for skilled workers, and it's more well-known because it ends up being classically programmers for companies like Microsoft come in on that visa. This is the unskilled component. These are people who don't have college degrees and typically don't have very much education at all, willing to come in to work for jobs that are close to minimum wage, never at minimum wage, but close to, at least under the rules. And employers are allowed to apply for this to the Department of Labor and bring in workers to do jobs in the U.S. that could range from crawfish peeling to tomato harvesting to certain kinds of very simple manufacturing type jobs to roofing. Really popular would be landscaping, you know, gardeners, that sort of thing. The whole basic conceit of the program is that you are supposed to make an effort to find Americans, and if you can't find an American who wants that job, then you can ask the Department of Labor for permission to bring in foreign workers to do it. And then you have to go to the DHS and get another round of permissions, and then finally the workers have to go interview with the State Department at a consulate outside the U.S., and if they get approved, they get a visa, and they can come into the U.S. to work for up to 10 months. But one of the quirks about the program is that the visa they get has the name of the company that sponsored their visa on it, and they're not allowed to work for any other company under the terms of the visa. And so sort of imagine having a job where you is the only place you could work for, and you couldn't be unemployed, because if you're unemployed, you'd have to leave the country, and you couldn't go work for another employer, because if you work for another employer, you'd be by definition illegal in the country, and you'd have to leave. So imagine going to that boss and asking for a raise with him knowing full well that there's absolutely nowhere else you can go and you have no leverage against him whatsoever. That's the basic working condition of these workers. And the result is that they have no leverage for these people. They come from typically very poor situations in generally poor parts of poor countries and are really desperate for work and for a source of income. And you can measure that by the fact that they'll leave their wife or their husband and children behind just so they can earn money and bring it back to them. Those are the people brought in those situations, and they're given no flexibility and no options about leaving. They're not well informed about their legal rights, such as they are, and they don't know how the American justice system works or how immigration law works. So they essentially come in and are brought in into a situation of powerlessness. And the exploitation that you asked about comes out of that, because it doesn't take long for employers to discover that this is a group of people who have no voice and have no weapons, nothing in their arsenal to push back on anything you want to do to them.
When was there a moment, a situation that you and Jessica were in during the reporting where you thought, oh my God, this is a huge story?
We went relatively early on. We went to Mexico because we wanted to go to a town where workers came from and just to see what, you know, who they were, where they came from, what their homes were like, and why they would give up so much to come here. And we went to a town called Topolobampo. And Topolobampo is a former fishing town, still sort of a fishing town on the coast of Mexico. It's in the heart of the drug country that we think of the drug country in Mexico, in the Sinaloa state. And actually, if you fly in, the airport you fly into is Los Mochis. Los Mochis is where Chapo Guzman was arrested a few weeks ago, to give you a sense of that, what part of Mexico we're talking about. And we drove into this town and met with a bunch of H-2 workers, former and present, and heard their stories and met with them in their homes. Some of them had organized in a way to try to get out information about how the program works and how they can protect themselves, because these people have been doing it for years and had seen lots of really bad abuses. So we spent a lot of time with these people. We must have gone to a couple dozen homes, heard dozens of stories, attended a meeting they had to get out information. About, I think, maybe 3 dozen or 4 dozen people showed up from different towns to hear about this and really immersed ourselves in that thing. Both of us speak some Spanish, which was obviously really helpful for that. And one day, I think towards the end of our time there, we decided to get some fish tacos. We were in Mexico in a little cute little fishing village. And so we stopped at this taco stand, and this waitress noticed that we were speaking English to each other. And she said, "Can I ask you a favor?" "Yeah, well, what is it?" "Well, can we look at this document I got in the mail from the U.S. government? I don't read English and I don't know what it is." And what it was a tax form from the IRS explaining money was owed to her from her job as an H-2 worker the previous year. And there was a little bit of an aha moment there, because we realized it dawned on us sort of that everyone in this town was or had been an H-2 worker or knew somebody who was. And we started asking just random people, and everyone was like, "Oh yeah, I am," or "My sister is," or "My cousin's gone right now." it touched everyone in this town, and it really kind of, and this is a poor town. There were people in this town who live in tin roof shacks with dirt floors, literally. And then you would go to the house of someone who had been an H2 worker, and they had nice tile floors. They had, you know, nice stoves and TVs, and had decent furniture. And really striking was on the wall was the picture of their kids' high school and sometimes college diplomas on the wall in a town where education was really, you know, not common. It was dawning on us that this was really huge. And we walked away from that experience being like, okay, we found something that's big and it's real and it's everywhere. And we got in the plane back, and Jessica, I think, turned to me and said, this story is really great and it also is really true. And I think as journalists, we can all agree that when a story is actually true, it feels extra good.
Extra good. So going back to something you said a little while ago, you mentioned the fact that this is a program designed for companies that can't find Americans to take jobs. But as you guys reported, it's not exactly true to form, and that some Americans are being passed over for jobs in place of foreigners. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So it's a difficult thing about this program for people to understand. And the truth is that I feel like some of the understanding could still be enhanced in the general public. There is a common feeling that when foreign workers come to the U.S., they're stealing American jobs. And it's something we've been hearing on the campaign stump in this presidential election a lot. And a lot of people who are Trump supporters, for example, have responded to our stories with that kind of rhetoric. But the real point we're trying to make there is that it isn't the Mexican worker or the Guatemalan worker or the Filipino worker who's stealing a job. That, in fact, that worker has a lot more in common with the American worker than with the employer. And these people all want to work. What we found is that the problem in the system and why there's Americans who can't find work when it relates to this visa is because the employers are passing them over on purpose. And so what we explored, as you asked about in this, was the devious ways and the tricky ways that employers find ways not to hire Americans. And it's a shocking list of sneaky stuff they do to do it. The legal requirement is that they put out newspaper ads. So they'll put newspaper ads, you know, a help wanted ad. They'll put out a help wanted ad in the wrong newspaper in the wrong state. Right? The job will be in Iowa, and they'll be advertising in New Mexico. I mean, if it's a minimum wage job or a $10 an hour job, how many people in New Mexico are going to want to move to Iowa for that job? Not too many. They will try to persuade workers on the phone not to apply. They'll threaten them and say that they shouldn't apply and that it would be dangerous for them. They'll lie to the Department of Labor about how many people applied. They will have people show up at some crazy hour to do some crazy test that they won't be able to pass. And so, and then they can claim to the government that no one was capable of a job or no one showed up. So they'll say, applicants must apply in person at 6 a.m. on Tuesday, and there's no public transport there. Many of them don't have cars. It's very, you know, all these hurdles they create to dissuade people from doing it. One example we found that I found kind of shocking involved corn detasseling in your home state, Charlie, in Michigan. Corn detasseling is a classic summer job for teenagers in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest. You have to remove the flowers from the plant that to control fertilization, and you want it has to do with controlling hybridization of the plant. And you just literally walk up and down the field pulling the flowers off the stalks. And for decades, teenagers have done that as a summer job. And lately, the H2 employers have figured out that they can bring in foreigners to do the job and get more done faster for less money. And so they've been taking over that business. And a group of people who are activists against this got out the word that these jobs are available and got Americans to apply for the jobs. And one teenager we discovered had, she was 13 years old, and this is going to be her first summer doing it, and she was really excited about her chance to have her first job. And she applied, and the woman who took the phone call in Florida, where the company was based, said, let me talk to your mother. When the mother and them finally got on the phone, essentially the recruiter told the mother that she shouldn't let her daughter apply because her daughter could get raped, and that if she took that job, there was lonely Mexican men in the fields, and they couldn't guarantee what would happen to her, and she wouldn't be safe. And it's, of course, it scared the pants off the mother, and the daughter didn't apply. Later, the daughter filed a complaint to the EEOC for gender discrimination, and it was really, from my perspective, sad because the EEOC allegedly investigated it, but we got a copy of the investigation papers, and there was no effort put into that investigation at all because they claimed they couldn't ever document that she called the company and was threatened by them. And yet there's a letter in the file from the law firm representing the company admitting that there was a phone call. So there was no dispute over the fact there's a phone call, but the EEOC closed the case saying there had been no, there was no proof of a phone call. and that's where they died. But that example is sort of consistent with stuff we saw everywhere, where companies would go out of their way to just keep Americans out of the fields, out of the factories, out of the jobs. They didn't want them. They would do anything they can not to hire them. There's a clip we found of a lawyer at an immigration legal summit where he said, in full of a room full of people and cameras, our job is to help you not hire Americans. Your goal is to not hire Americans.
Wow.
So I was curious, you have this litany of like horrific abuses of both workers and the system. There doesn't seem to be very much ramification for even employers who routinely are caught out doing something horrible.
How do I feel about that?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the frustrations about this program is that the people who are most hurt by it are among the most voiceless in culture and society. We have displaced American workers who tend to be poor and not particularly well-educated. Well, we already know that's not a very powerful political constituency in this country. And then we have foreign workers who are being exploited. They're actually lower on the political pecking order than undocumented workers in this country, because politicians and others in the public sphere recognize that while undocumented workers can't vote, their children will be able to vote, and therefore they have some political importance. Foreign workers who come into this country for 10 months and then going home are by definition invisible in that world, and no one cares about their voice. And it is very difficult to get anyone in the public sphere to do anything about this and to stand up for these people, because they don't feel like expending political capital on people who are so marginalized. A good example of this would be senators like Barbara Mikulski, who is generally thought of someone as somewhat of a lion of the left, someone who has been great on women's issues over the years. She has been an incredible booster of the H2 program over the years. And it turns out the reason is because Maryland, where she's from, has a big crab industry, and the crab industry depends on the H-2B visa. And almost all the women who do this job, which involves standing over a table picking the meat out of crabs for 14 hours a day, are women from Mexico. And those women have suffered terrible abuses, but year after year, Mikulski is up there fighting for this program. And I think that one of the things we encountered reporting these stories was how even people in the Department of Labor who recognize the program doesn't work can't figure out a way to solve the problem. And, you know, I think it's important to note something else, which is the workers aren't asking for this program to end, right? And I think that's an interesting issue. When we first went into this thing, we thought, well, maybe the way to solve this is just get rid of the H-2 program. But actually, if you talk to workers, universally, they want the program to continue to exist. And if I can tell you a little story, when we left that town in Mexico, this guy named Fausto, who's an incredible guy, who was one of the first people from Mexico to go to Louisiana on this program almost 30 years ago, said to us, we were walking into the Los Mochis airport, and he stopped us and he grabbed my arm and he said, you know, please go back and please write a story that'll help make the conditions better for workers. But I'm begging you, if what you do shuts down the program, don't even write an article at all, because we would rather be exploited than unemployed. And I think that's kind of part of the heart of the problem, is that workers are a little reticent to raise their voice out of fear, and also because they don't want to, despite the abuses, they consider this to be their best economic option.
Such a tricky situation, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing details of your investigation and really raising questions about how to solve this without sort of undermining a program that's a lifeline for our workers. So thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Tracy. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.